Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Siegel, Judge Riley, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 27 panel, oral arguments. The first case on our calendar this morning is Ta versus Ryan Rentals. And for the sake of the audio recording and for the parties, I'll just remind you, we are providing an audio recording of the presentation, as we always do, despite the fact that we're appearing today and we can see each other in our pictures and our names on the screen. We're only making an audio recording, so please do continue with our usual practice of providing your name as you begin each of your argument legs. That way we can make sure that we're attaching the right lawyer to the right argument for the purposes of our recording. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use it for rebuttal. And if we have any technological issues with the Zoom platform, just wave your hand or somehow alert us if you're having difficulty hearing any of the judges or your opposing counsel, and we'll try to do what we can to make adjustments so that everybody is participating equally. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Courtney Sebo-Savica, and I represent the appellant, Ryan Rentals, LLC, in this matter. I would like to use my 5 minutes, excuse me, of rebuttal. We are here today with a very narrow focus, which is this: how does the inclusion of the word substantial into Minnesota Statute Section 504B.211 impact that statute? And more specifically, does the existence of that word substantial in the statute require a different level of conduct than if the word were not there?
Can I throw in a suggestion to you? I don't want to, maybe you want to get into more of the whether there was a violation argument than the word substantial. I mean, I'm not speaking on behalf of the panel, but usually when I see the word substantial, it's not an enhanced violation that we're looking for, perhaps less of a violation. The question is, well, did you comply with the terms of the contract? Well, I substantially complied usually means that, well, maybe it's not a technical compliance, but it's close enough to call it compliance. And it seems to me that the reason substantial is in there is to soften the standard rather than to heighten it, as your argument goes. Now, I don't speak on behalf of the panel. I'm just going to throw that out there. And you can use your time however you want to use it.
Thank you. So I will respond to that. So if we are looking at the word substantial as sort of a softening of the standard, then absolutely, yes. I think Ryan Rentals' conduct doesn't come close to even the softening of that standard. And the reason is because, of course, the unit was vacant at the time that the entry was made. So
tell me where in the statute you believe that whether the tenant is present or absent, either in person or with her possessions, bears on whether the tenant is entitled to a penalty, because the statute says a landlord may not enter the premises rented by a residential tenant. So I gather your argument is if she's not present, she's not renting.
So also under the statute 504B.211, there is a list of reasonable business purposes for entering. So that's where I'm getting from the statute this possibility that even when a tenant has vacated premises, as the tenant did do here, that still falls under the auspices of this reasonable business purpose, requiring the landlord to provide notice for entering. So
I'm trying to understand that argument, because I think you claim that in your primary brief was that it had a reasonable business purpose to because Todd, the respondent, had vacated the premises. But the district court found that your client learned that Todd moved out only upon entering the apartment. And so doesn't that undermine your argument that there was a reasonable business purpose to enter because she vacated?
So the district court also found that Ms. Ta had provided notice that she would be vacating the premises and had in fact
that she was continuing to pay her rent.
Yes. So she was continuing to pay rent. So the question then becomes, does a residential tenant's right to privacy survive that tenant's leaving the property, vacating the property, abandoning the premises and the obligations and all the other obligations under the lease other than to pay? But then also, does that residential tenant's right to privacy survive even the ability to access the apartment? So yes, the district court did.
Why are you calling this a right to privacy? This seems like the statute creates a bright line do not enter rule, not a do not enter in order to intrude on someone's privacy. Is there something in the statute that you think triggers this privacy standard as opposed to an entry standard?
So the statute itself, 504B.211, is called the Residential Tenant's Right to Privacy Statute.
Well, the legislature has told us not to look at headings that are not included as part of the legislature's passage, that these are just, I forgot the word, catchphrases, I think is what the legislature says. And in fact, there's a statute that says we're supposed to do that. So is there something in the text of the statute that elevates this to a right of privacy as opposed to a right of avoiding entry?
Other than the statute's language read together and then the heading, and then of course, the Gebrethewit versus Neum case, which is an unpublished Court of Appeals case from 2016, where the Court of Appeals actually looked at the statute as a residential tenant's right to privacy. Those are the those are how we're viewing this as a residential tenant's right to privacy.
So just so I understand, you're acknowledging there's nothing in the text of the statute and that you're relying upon an unpublished decision, which is not binding on any court. And you're relying upon the heading, which is not, the legislature says we're not supposed to rely upon. Other than that, there's nothing you've got.
So I don't know that I could agree with that statement. I feel the unpublished case in the Gebrethewit matter is actually an instructive case for the court here today. And the reason it's instructive is because the substantial violation portion of this statute requires there to have been some sort of substantial violation by a landlord for entering the unit. In this case, if we do a search of Minnesota case law to try to find some precedent, some published cases, the only published cases from the appellate courts deal with Fourth Amendment search and seizure entries. So those are cases where a landlord has admitted entrance to police to allow a search and seizure. The police have discovered evidence that then the prosecution has tried to introduce at the trial. And then there's been a question as to whether or not the landlord's initial entry, allowance of entry with the police was sufficient.
You do recognize, I assume, that the rights of the Constitution, the rights of a statute, are always going to be more protective of an individual than the rights of the embedded in the Constitution. The Constitution is just a floor, isn't it?
Of course, absolutely.
So why would we apply the Fourth Amendment standard and rather than the statutory standard?
So this is not applying the Fourth Amendment standard. It is looking at how the courts have reviewed this substantial violation verbiage in the statute. So
I'm sorry, finish. And then Judge Ross, is it okay if I ask a question?
Of course,
okay, go ahead and finish. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say that the whether or not there's been a substantial violation is what triggers the district court to impose a penalty. And so these Fourth Amendment search and seizure cases are the only cases that are published that look at whether or not there's been a substantial violation.
Okay. So it seems like your client concedes that there is at least, I think, what you've termed a technical violation of that statute. And so then aren't we really looking at the severity of the penalty? And then aren't we in abuse of discretion territory? So is that your argument, that there's been an abuse of discretion because this is just kind of a minor invasion rather than a major invasion? And I mean, I guess you've already said there's no precedent really to help you out there, but that's your argument. Is that right?
So the first step is, of course, to determine whether or not there was a substantial violation. So that's de novo, applying the facts of the case to whether or not there was a substantial violation under the statute. Then the second step is...
But it seems like you've conceded that, a technical violation is a violation. And so I tend to think of the word substantially violates as something less than violates. So isn't that sort of a given that there's been a violation then?
So, and unfortunately,
if we view the word that way, a severe violation. I mean, I don't know, the language that the legislature chose was substantially violates, which, means, I don't know, or how where do you land on the fact that it means something more than a violation? It has to be a really bad violation.
I look at, unfortunately, all I have is the Gabrethewit case and then also the Fourth Amendment search and seizure cases. In Gabrethewit, the district court found substantial to equate to egregious.
That's substantial in a different context, of course, than the statute. Can I take you back to your first response that this was an appropriate entry because there was a reasonable business exception? I'm going to press on that in a couple of ways, and you tell me whether you think I'm wrong or not. I'm curious as to how it would be a business purpose to enter a vacated property if the tenant is continuing to pay rent. So I can understand why a landlord would go into a property that has been vacated and about which the tenant is not paying rent. So the landlord can make the property ready to lease to another person and mitigate damages. I'm not sure how it could be a business purpose to enter into a property for which the landlord is receiving the full benefit of the lease because the tenant continues to pay. And second to that, even if there's a reasonable business purpose in entering the property in September, while Ms. Ta continues to pay rent, the statute still requires notice beforehand. So I'm not sure how that gets you any further along in your argument. So those are my two concerns, and you can address them in any order or however you'd like.
Okay. So first of all, entering vacated premises is, of course, listed as a reasonable business purpose under the statute. There aren't any facts on the record that would assist me in answering your question other than the court's question, other than speculating as to why, and hopefully that's sufficient if I were to say, yes, a reasonable business purpose for entering a vacant apartment is to do that, what we just described, mitigating damages. So
my question was assuming there were no mitigating damages because there's no damages if she continues to pay rent, which she was.
Right. So, and I'm not sure as this entry occurred on September 3rd, presuming rent was paid by September 1st, there had still been an indication, more than an indication, Ms. Ta had expressed an intent to get out of the lease. She asked to break the lease at the end of August. And at that point, said that she would be breaking the lease. The district court found that she had notified the landlord that she would be vacating the premises, abandoning the premises. So there is, of course, And landlords can, once premises have been abandoned under the landlord-tenant code, they can go in, they can retake possession. They can also take possession of all the personal items that are in there. In this
unless the tenant is still paying rent. But go back to the second part of my question, which is, even assuming that this was a reasonable business purpose, which I'm not convinced, but let's assume that it was, the statute still says good faith effort to give notice of entry first is required. So isn't it still a violation, a technical violation or substantial, however you look at it, if your client entered without notice, even on a reasonable purpose?
So a landlord can actually provide notice after the entry by leaving a note behind that says, I accessed your property. This is the date of the entry. And this is the purpose of the entry.
Well, so that's only under certain circumstances. The statute says you can enter the premises under subdivision 2 for a reasonable business purpose and after making a good faith effort to give the residential tenant reasonable notice. The statute still requires the landlord to give notice of entry, but that provision is not a pass for the landlord to get around the good faith prior notice requirement, is it?
Of course not. No, there's no reason, there's no attempt to try and get around. Of course, the parties agreed that there should be protection of a residential right, tenant's right to privacy. Absolutely. And that the statute should be followed. In this case, because Ms. Ta had indicated that she would be leaving the premises, that she wouldn't be there and then was in fact gone.
Although your time is up, I have another question that I'll just ask you to put in the back burner. You can think about it and maybe provide an answer when you provide your rebuttal argument, which is, how is your client prejudiced? Let's assume that the district court inappropriately sua sponte imposed a penalty. I'm curious as to how your client was prejudiced by the sua sponte nature of it. If your client had been given proper notice that the court was considering the penalty, what is the possible argument additionally that your client would have made to have avoided the penalty or come out with a different outcome? So you can bounce it around in your mind and respond.
Judge Ross, I have another question you to answer on rebuttal. I just want to be clear what remedy you're seeking. You want us to reverse a district court order, but is that with regard to the, I'll call them sanctions, penalties that the judge imposed on you, or is that also with regard to the judge saying that the lease was over as of September, the end of September?
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions that we want to offer up for Ms. Sable to consider? No? All right. Something to think about. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brian Wisdorf, WISDORF, on behalf of the respondent, Alicia Ta. May it please the court. The district court held that appellant failed to give my client notice, and that was a substantial violation of subdivision 2. The entry at issue occurred on September 3rd, 2020. Appellant is not disputing the finding of fact that it failed to give the respondent notice of entry prior to entering the premises. Appellant is not disputing that none of the exceptions under subdivision 4 applied to her client. Obviously, the court reviews the applications of law determine if there was any erroneous application, but the court reviews the conclusions under an abuse of discretion standard.
How does the district court's imposition of a penalty under 504B, how does the sua sponte introduction of that issue and the imposition of the penalty comport with due process?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there was anything sua sponte about what the court did. I believe that the complaint identified that there was an entry in which the door was damaged, and that it, as part of the complaint attached to it, was a letter from the appellant's counsel that indicated that he that the appellant had entered the property on September 3rd, and due to the fact that it didn't have a key, that it had had to basically break the lock in order to get in. So therefore, it was before the court.
The facts may have been before the court, but the issue of the penalty, which would include both whether there was a substantial violation and the extent or amount of any penalty, whether to impose a penalty and what the penalty should be, those questions weren't before the district court, were they?
The issue of oral argument or specific applications of the penalty provision under the statute, subdivision 6, was not argued by the attorneys, nor were the specific remedies requested under subdivision 6. And the basis for that was that under the statute, it is my position that the district court has discretion to apply one or more of those remedies that are available if it finds that there has been a violation of the statute.
Shouldn't the parties be able to argue to the district court whether there was a substantial violation or not a substantial violation, regardless of what the facts are, even if it seems really clear? Shouldn't the parties be on notice that that issue is in front of them so they can present both legal and factual argument?
Well, I think the opportunity for counsels to argue whether or not there was a violation is in reality why you're in court to begin with. When an action is brought for a breach of the obligations under the statute, that the whether or not it is my position that, you know, if there isn't a business purpose, or if you're able to establish a business, if there isn't a business purpose, you have a substantial violation. If you have a business purpose, but you don't give notice prior to entry, and you didn't make a good faith effort to provide notice before entering and posted a notice when you left that you entered, or one of the exceptions doesn't apply, then you have a substantial violation. So,
I mean, I think you've got a good that's a good argument on the merits. My argument is my question goes to procedural due process. That is the basic elements of which are notice and the opportunity to be heard. So let me frame it more specifically. When did the district court or either party put the appellant on notice that a penalty under 504B211 was at issue in this proceeding?
I believe that by claiming that there was a breach of Minnesota Section 504B.211 Subdivision 2, that by putting the appellant on notice that that was a claim being made, that they are put on notice that the penalties under Subdivision 6 are in play if they are found to be in violation.
Even if that statute was invoked based upon not the September 3rd entry, but the August entry, which the court found not to be a violation.
Well, again, I believe that the appellant did have notice of the September 3rd, 2020 entry being at issue based upon the allegations in the complaint and the exhibit attached. It didn't necessarily specifically speak It spoke of this August 27th entry, but it also referenced other entries as well with no date specific outside of the exhibit itself.
Let's assume we disagreed with you on the question of the sua sponte nature of the district court's decision. What should the remedy be?
Well, I don't, for the reasons stated before, I don't believe that the appellant was prejudiced by the sua sponte nature of the district court's raising the issue of the September 3rd, 2020 entry as it was in front of the court based upon what the allegations and the pleadings, and therefore for the court to look at that issue at that time, I don't believe created a prejudice to the appellant. The appellant was present with his attorney and had an opportunity to present testimony on that issue. And for that reason, I don't believe there was a prejudice.
Now, we've asked Ms. Sabo Savica to address the question of prejudice in her rebuttal. Let's assume for the sake of hypotheticals that she knocks it out of the park and she convinces us that there was prejudice in the sua sponte nature of the court proceeding under the penalty provision for the September 3rd entry. What would you recommend the remedy would be if we agreed with her about that only?
If the appellate court found that the appellant was prejudiced by the sua sponte nature of the district court's finding of a violation on September 3rd, 2020, what should be the remedy? Is that my understanding?
What would be the remedy on appeal? What would you ask us to do?
I would ask the court to still affirm the decision, but I would suspect that in such a scenario that it would probably be a remand with the court to provide the appellant probably an opportunity to be heard on that issue.
Thank you. I assume you had more to argue on the merits before.
Yes, thank you. All right. So with regards to the appellant's argument of multiple violate, there were some arguments in the brief about multiple violations and egregious behavior and some citations to unreported cases. There's nothing in the statute that requires that there's a requirement of multiple violations or that there's an egregious element required in order to be considered substantial. In fact, in the case of Garbrett, the case cited and spoke about by appellant, what the district court or the appellate court was reviewing there was the district court's order in which it actually identified in a specific entry to being egregious and therefore wasn't creating an egregious requirement, but was simply looking at the language that was provided in that opinion in which it was evaluating whether or not whether or not egregious behavior occurred. It wasn't a finding by the court that that needs to be shown in order for a substantial violation to occur.
How do you recommend that we interpret the term substantial? If you were going to offer up a synonym, either a synonym or a synonym phrase for the term substantial as we discern the meaning of it in this statute, what would you offer for us?
I would say that it would be something that comes close to a direct violation. As I articulated before, I mean, I'm more of a, you know, you hit the dots. It's either a business purpose. Did you give the notice? You know, check the box type thing. And if you can't check the right boxes, then you have a violation. To me, it gives the court discretion for substantial violation to say, well, depending upon the circumstances, if you check all the right boxes, or if one's still in real gray area based upon maybe whether you made a genuine effort to give that notice, that may bring in that gray area. Well, you may have done a genuine effort, but we still find there to be a substantial violation.
Sort of a functional equivalent test?
Yes. As for the district court's remedy, the district court explained why the remedy is awarded under 504B 211 subdivision six were appropriate. The district court found on September 3rd, 2020, defendant entered the premises by damaging the entrance lock and door. The defendant did not provide plaintiff any notice, nor did it make a good faith effort to provide such notice.
You're not suggesting the damage to the door should benefit the tenant. I mean, how would that benefit the tenant? Your client has vacated. She doesn't have any property left there. She may have a right to possess the property, but as far as damage to the door, the landlord would be responsible for paying for that out of the landlord's pocket, right?
Correct. No, I don't think that that's necessary in order to find a substantial violation. I think it's just one of the facts of this case. I think ultimately, again, you have to have your business purpose, and then it goes to notice. Once you give note, you know, if how they ultimately get in when you have a forced entry of some sort clearly shows, takes away this any idea of the tenant having opened the door, like you have in the Richter v. Kuzik unreported case cited by me in my brief. Again, situation where you have a claim of a violation, but if the tenant lets them in, there's no violation. And in that case, they found that there wasn't a violation because on the first two occasions, they had let them in. On the third occasion, they couldn't establish that the landlord actually entered the premises. So so for purposes of establishing a violation, no. Is it necessarily relevant that the lock was broke in order to gain entry? I don't think it necessarily is, because I don't think it's in dispute that the appellant entered the property without providing notice, or the respondent providing the appellant with access.
Thank you. Any other questions by the other panel members? Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So to answer the court's first question as to how Ryan Rentals is prejudiced by the sua sponte nature of the proceeding, of the decision, I should say. So number one, of course, just not having an opportunity to be heard in open court. These are difficult proceedings. This was noticed as an eviction hearing. It wasn't an eviction hearing. It was a tenant remedies proceeding.
So how is your client prejudiced by not having the opportunity to be heard at that time? Let's assume that we agree with Mr. Wisdorf that if you convince us there was prejudice, it should go back to the district court. But in order to show prejudice, you're going to have to show that the outcome might have been different if your client had gotten notice. So your client, let's assume your client had gotten notice, and your client therefore would have said what different from what your client actually said during the proceeding?
Well, first of all, my client didn't say anything at the proceeding about this issue because it wasn't raised. There was no opportunity.
No, I get that. So what would but there was evidence about the entry in September 3rd. So, and the nature of the entry. So what would your client have offered that would have changed the district court's mind as to the finding of fact that your client violated the statute?
So, first of all, could potentially have introduced evidence of notice that could have been an issue that would have been raised. The client was there at the proceeding. My client was there at the proceeding. Could have provided testimony as to whether or not there was even notice given.
I thought the record was pretty clear about all the notice that was given and that there was no notice given except for what was in the record. Are you suggesting that there was notice?
So my understanding was that there was notice that was given after the fact. There was a note that was left behind.
Right. Well, that doesn't help get around whether there's a statutory violation. I think you acknowledge that, don't you?
Correct. So if there were, first of all, there was prejudice in the fact that appellant was present at the proceeding. He could have given testimony. If this issue had been raised, there could have been questions that were asked about the situation.
I'm just trying to understand what that evidence would be. So in order to show prejudice, you would let us know, for example, well, if my client would have been able to testify, he would have introduced this evidence or that evidence, and the outcome would have been different or might have been different on the question of whether there's a violation. So my question now to you is, on what basis would we say that that's even a plausible consideration?
Well, certainly, in addition, the question as to whether or not this was a substantial violation. So that is an argument that could have been had at the district court, that the arguments that we're making now could have been made at the district court at that point, at that time, with all the parties present. No.
But if it turns out that we believe that the word substantial is certainly not greater than a violation, and you've acknowledged that there was a violation, and that doesn't show prejudice either, does it?
Having found that there was no substantial violation?
Well, if there's an opportunity to argue a legal issue that's doomed, that doesn't demonstrate prejudice.
Correct. So that the prejudice then, in this situation, the arguments that could have been made at the district court level would have been related to the substantial violation, which the court is saying is kind of a moot point at this point. But then also the notice, whether or not there was any notice, whether or not this was a reasonable business purpose, whether or not subdivision 4 potentially would have applied to the situation.
This is where I'm having problems with your argument. In your primary brief, you say that you didn't give notice, and that's at page 18. So I don't know how further testimony would deal with that. And then the second thing is that in your primary brief, you say that the reasonable business purpose was that the tenant had vacated the apartment. I don't know how you get around that, because you didn't know she had vacated, or your client didn't know until after you entered the apartment. So those are the two main two problems I'm having with your argument as it goes to prejudice and what further testimony you would have provided.
So again, the district court found that she had provided notice that she would be leaving, vacating the premises. So there, and there's been no dispute that she notified the landlord that she would be gone. As far as the first issue, which is that of there, the question of what would happen on remand, our argument again is that, and it seems to be an argument that we've gotten lots of questions on today, but it is in regards to whether or not this is a substantial violation. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of case law on this issue. The only case law is in relation to Fourth Amendment search and seizure and entry in that regard, and then the Gabrethwaite case.
Judge Riley had a different question for you to ponder during the break, and did you have a chance? Have you answered that already, or would you like a chance to answer that question?
No, thank you, Your Honor. So the remedy that we're seeking would be a reversal of the conclusion that there is a substantial violation and the imposition of the penalties associated therewith. We acknowledged at the district court proceeding that there was no breach because rent was continuing to be made. So at this point, we have no request that that issue be reversed.
Any other questions from the panel? Seeing none. Thank you both, counsel. Very interesting case. I don't think I've seen one quite like this one before, but I definitely appreciate your briefing and your oral argument today. And with that, the matter is submitted. We'll take it under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you.
You too. You as well.